and the old calèche with mended mudguards drove up gloomily but resolutely to the covered, sand-strewn portico. Taking leave of the Princess Barbara and of the men was unpleasant to Dolly. After spending a day together, both she and her host felt distinctly that they did not suit one another, and that it was better for them not to associate. Only Anna felt sad. She knew that when Dolly was gone, no one would call up in her soul the feelings which had been aroused by their meeting. To have those feelings awakened was painful, but still she knew that they were the best part of her soul, and that that part of her was rapidly being choked by the life she was leading. When they had driven into the fields, Dolly experienced a pleasant feeling of relief, and she was about to ask the men how they had liked the Vronskys' place, when suddenly Philip, the coachman, himself remarked,
"They're rich, that they are. But yet they gave us only 2 bushels of oats. The horses had eaten every grain before cockcrow. What's 2 bushels? Only a bite. Nowadays oats are 45 kopecks at the inns. When anyone comes to our place, no fear, we give their horses as much as they'll eat."
"A stingy gentleman," confirmed the clerk.
"Well, and did you like their horses?" asked Dolly.
"The horses? Fine's the only word for them. And the food is good, too. But it did seem so dull to me, Darya Alexandrovna. I don't know how you found it," he added, turning his handsome, kindly face toward her.
"I felt the same. Well, shall we get back by evening?"
"We ought to."
On returning home and finding everyone safe and extremely nice, Dolly gave a very animated account of her visit, of how well she had been received, of the luxury and good taste at the Vronskys, and of their amusements, and would not let anyone say a word against them. "One must know Anna and Vronsky. I have got to know him better now, in order to understand how kind and pathetic they are," said she with entire sincerity, forgetting the indefinite feelings of dissatisfaction and embarrassment she had experienced there. Chapter 25. Vronsky and Anna went on living in the country in the same way, still taking no steps to obtain a divorce, all the summer and part of the autumn. They had agreed not to go away anywhere, but the longer they lived alone, the more they both felt, especially in autumn when there were no visitors, that they would not be able to hold out, and that a change was inevitable. Their life seemed one that could not be improved upon. They had ample means, good health, a child, and both had occupations of their own. In the absence of visitors, Anna still continued to devote attention to her person, and read a great deal, both novels and such serious books as were in fashion. She ordered all the books that were praised in the foreign newspapers and magazines they received, and read them with the attention one gives only to what one reads in solitude. She studied also from books and from technical papers all the subjects with which Vronsky was occupied, so that he often came straight to her with questions about agriculture, architecture, and sometimes even horse breeding or sport. He was astounded at her knowledge and memory, and at first used to doubt her information and want it confirmed. She would then find what he wanted in books and show it him. The arrangement of the hospital also interested her. There she not only helped, but arranged and planned many things herself. Nevertheless, her chief preoccupation was still herself. Herself insofar as Vronsky held her dear, and insofar as she could compensate him for all he had given up. Vronsky appreciated this, which had become the sole aim of her life, a desire not only to please him, but also to serve him. But at the same time he was troubled by these love meshes in which she tried to entangle him. As time went on, the oftener he felt himself caught in these meshes, the more he desired, not exactly to escape from them, but to try whether they really interfered with his freedom. Had it not been for this ever-increasing desire for freedom, not to have a scene each time he had to go to town to a meeting or to the races, Vronsky would have been quite content with his life. The role he had chosen, that of a rich landowner, one of those who should constitute the kernel of the Russian aristocracy, was not only quite to his taste, but now that he had lived so for half a year, gave him ever-increasing pleasure. His affairs, which occupied and absorbed him more and more, progressed excellently. In spite of the tremendous sums, the hospital, the machinery, the cows which he imported from Switzerland, and many other things were costing him, he was sure that he was not wasting his substance, but increasing it. Where it was a question of income, the sale of forest land, of corn or wool, or the leasing of land, Vronsky was as hard as flint and could hold out for his price. In all operations on a large scale, both on this and on his other estates, he kept to the simplest and safest methods, and was extremely economical and careful in his expenditure on small details. Despite all the cunning and artfulness of the German steward, who tried to lead him into expenditure and presented all estimates in such a way that it at first appeared as if much would be required, though on consideration the thing could be done more cheaply and an immediate profit obtained, Vronsky did not submit to him. He listened to what the steward had to say and questioned him, but only consented when the things to be ordered or built were the latest, as yet unknown in Russia and likely to astonish people. Besides, he decided on a big outlay only when he had money to spare, and when spending he went into every detail and insisted on getting the very best for his money. So that from the way he managed his business, it was clear that he was not wasting, but increasing his property. In October, there were the nobility elections in the Kashin province, in which Vronsky's, Viatsky's, Koznishev's, and also a small part of Lievin's estates were situated. Various circumstances, as well as the men who took part in them, caused these elections to attract public attention. They were much discussed, and preparations were made for them. People living in Moscow and Petersburg, as well as others from abroad, who had never come to any elections, assembled at these. Vronsky had long ago promised Sviatsky to be present. Before the election, Sviatsky, who often visited at Vozvizenskoy, called for Vronsky. The day before, Vronsky and Anna had almost quarrelled about his proposed journey. It was autumn, the dullest and most depressing time of year in the country, and so Vronsky, bracing himself for a struggle, announced his departure in a sterner and colder way than he had ever before used to Anna. But to his surprise, Anna took the news very quietly, and only asked when he would return. He looked at her attentively, not understanding this calm manner. She answered his look with a smile. He knew her capacity for withdrawing into herself, and knew that she only did it when she had come to some resolution in her own mind without telling him of her plans. He feared this. But he so wished to avoid a scene that he pretended to believe, and to some extent sincerely believed, in what he wished to believe, namely in her reasonableness.
"I hope you won't be dull."
"I hope not," replied Anna. "I received a box of books from Gautier's yesterday. No, I shan't be dull." "She means to adopt this tone? Well, so much the better," thought he, "or else it would be the usual thing again." And so, without challenging her to a frank explanation, he left for the elections. It was the first time since their union that he had parted from her without a full explanation. On the one hand, this fact disturbed him, but on the other hand, it seemed the best way. "At first there will be, as now, something uncertain, something concealed. But afterwards she will get used to it. In any case, I can give her everything else, but not my independence as a man," he reflected.
Chapter 26. In September, Lievin moved to Moscow for Kitty's confinement. He had already been living there a whole month without occupation when Sergei Ivanich Koznishev, who had an estate in the Kashin province and took a great interest in the forthcoming elections, prepared to attend them. He asked his brother, who had a vote for the Seleznev district, to accompany him. Lievin had also some very important business to attend to in Kashin for his sister, who lived abroad. It was in connection with a wardship and the receiving of money due to her for land transferred to the peasants. Lievin was still wavering, but
But Kitty, who had noticed that he was dull in Moscow and had advised him to go, without saying anything to him, ordered for him the uniform necessary for the occasion, which cost 80 rubles. And it was these 80 rubles paid for the uniform which chiefly decided him. So he went to Kashin. Levin had been 5 days in Kashin, going daily to meetings and taking a great deal of trouble over his sister's business, which he was still unable to arrange. The marshals of the nobility were all busy with the elections, and he could not get even the simple matter in connection with the wardship settled. The other business, that of getting the money paid, also met with obstacles. After long efforts to get an injunction removed, the money was all ready to be paid out. But the notary, a very obliging man, could not give the warrant because it needed the president's signature, and the president was engaged at the session and had not appointed a substitute. All those worries, the going from place to place, conversations with very kind, good people who quite understood the unpleasantness of the petitioner's position but were unable to help him, and all these efforts which yielded no results, produced in Levin a painful feeling akin to the vexatious helplessness one experiences when trying to employ physical force in a dream. He felt this frequently when talking to his very good-natured legal adviser. This legal adviser seemed to do all that was possible and to strain every nerve to get Levin out of his difficulties. "Look here," he would say, "just try this. Go to so-and-so and to so-and-so." And the adviser would make an elaborate plan to circumvent the fatal difficulty which was at the root of all this trouble. But he would immediately add, "All the same, you will be put off. However, have a try." And Levin tried and went again and again. Everybody was kind and amiable, but still it turned out that what he wanted to circumvent started up again in another place and impeded him once more. It was specially annoying to Levin to be quite unable to understand with whom he was contending and whom the delay in his business could profit. No one, not even his lawyer, seemed to know this. If Levin could have understood it, as he understood the reason for having to stand in a queue at a booking office, he would not have felt hurt or vexed. But no one could explain to him the reason for the obstacles he encountered in these business transactions. However, Levin had changed considerably since his marriage. He had become patient, and if he did not understand why things were arranged thus, he told himself that, not knowing everything, he could not judge, and that probably things had to be so, and he tried not to be indignant. And now, being present at the elections and taking part in them, he also tried not to condemn, not to dispute, but as far as possible to understand the matter on which good and honest men whom he respected were engaged with so much seriousness and enthusiasm. Since his marriage, so many new and serious aspects of life had been revealed to him, which, owing to his superficial acquaintance with them, had formerly seemed unimportant, that he anticipated and looked for a serious meaning in this election business also. Koznishev explained to him the meaning and importance of the changes anticipated as a result of the elections. The marshal of the nobility for the province, in whose hands the law placed so much important public business, wardships such as the one about which Levin was now in trouble, the care of enormous sums of money belonging to the nobility, public schools for boys and girls, military schools, elementary education according to the new law, and finally the Zemstvo, the marshal of the province, Snetkov, was one of the old type of nobles. He had run through an enormous fortune, was a kind man, honest in his way, but quite unable to understand present-day requirements. He always sided with the nobility in everything, openly opposed the spread of popular education, and gave a class character to the Zemstvo, which should have such enormous importance. It was necessary to put in his place a fresh, up-to-date, practical, and quite new man, and to manage matters so as to extract from the rights granted to the nobility, not as nobles but as an element of the Zemstvo, all the advantages of self-government which could be obtained from them. In the wealthy province of Kashin, always ahead of all others, such forces were now assembled that, if matters were here managed as they should be, it might serve as an example to other provinces and to the whole of Russia. The affair was therefore of great importance. To replace Snetkov as marshal, Sviatsky was proposed, or better still, Nevadovsky, an ex-professor, a remarkably intelligent man, and a great friend of Koznishev's. The session was opened by the governor of the province, who, in his speech to the nobles, told them that in choosing occupants for posts they should show no partiality, but should choose according to merit and for the welfare of the country, and that he hoped the honourable nobility of Kashin would strictly fulfil its duty as it had done in previous elections, and would justify their sovereign's high confidence in them. Having finished his speech, the governor left the hall, and the noblemen noisily, vivaciously, some of them even rapturously, followed him out with enthusiasm, and stood around him as he was putting on his fur coat and talking in a friendly way with the marshal of the province. Lievin, wishing to enter fully into everything and not to miss anything, stood there too in the crowd, and heard the governor say, "Please tell Maria Ivanovna that my wife is very sorry she has to go to the orphanage." Then the noblemen gaily scrambled for their overcoats, and all drove to the cathedral. In the cathedral, Lievin, with the others, raised his hand, repeating the words of the priest, and swore by the most awful oaths to fulfil all the things the governor had hoped for. Church services always touched Lievin, and when he was uttering the words, "I kiss the cross," and looked round at the crowd of men, young and old, who were repeating the same words, he felt moved. On the second and third days, matters were dealt with concerning the funds of the nobility and the girls' high schools, which Koznishev explained were quite unimportant. So Lievin, busy going from place to place on the business he had in hand, did not trouble about them. On the fourth day, the audit of the provincial funds was undertaken, and now for the first time there was a conflict between the new and old parties. The commission entrusted with the task of auditing reported to the assembly that the sums were all correct. The marshal of the nobility rose, and with tears in his eyes, thanked the nobility for their confidence. The nobles loudly applauded him and pressed his hand. But at that moment, one of the nobles of Koznishev's party said he had heard that the commission had not audited the funds, considering that a verification would be an insult to the marshal of the province. A member of the commission imprudently confirmed this. Then a small, very young-looking, but very venomous man began saying that probably the marshal of the province would be pleased to account for the funds, and that the excessive politeness of the members of the commission was depriving him of that moral satisfaction. Thereupon the members of the commission withdrew their report, and Koznishev began very logically to prove that they must admit either that they had audited the accounts or that they had not done so, and to elaborate this dilemma. A speaker of the opposite party replied to Koznishev. Then Sviatsky spoke, and then the venomous gentleman once more. The debate continued for a long time and did not come to any conclusion. Lievin was surprised that they disputed about it so long, especially as, when he asked Koznishev whether he thought that money had been misappropriated, he received the reply, "Oh no, he's an honest fellow. But this old-fashioned patriarchal and family management of the nobility's affairs must be put a stop to." On the fifth day, the election of the district marshals took place. For some of the districts, the election was stormy enough, but for the Seletsensk district, Sviatsky was elected without opposition, and he gave a dinner party at his house that evening. Chapter 27. On the sixth day, the provincial elections were to be held. The large and small halls were full of noblemen in various uniforms. Many had come for that day only. Men who had long not met, some from the Crimea, some from Petersburg, and some from abroad, came together in those halls. At the marshal's table, beneath the portrait of the emperor, discussions were in full swing. Both in the large and small halls, the noblemen were grouped together in their parties, and from the hostility and suspicion of their glances, from the cessation of their conversations when a stranger approached, and from the fact that some of them even went whispering into the farther corridor, it was evident that each party had secrets it kept from the other. By their external appearance, the nobles were sharply divided into two sorts, the old and the young. The old,
For the most part, either wore old-fashioned, buttoned-up uniforms of their class and carried swords and hats, or wore the naval, cavalry, or infantry uniforms to which each was individually entitled. The uniforms of the old noblemen were cut in the old-fashioned way, with puffs at the shoulders, and were clearly too small for them, being short-waisted and narrow, as if their wearers had grown out of them. The young men wore long-waisted, loose uniforms, wide across the shoulders, with white waistcoats, or else were in uniforms with black collars embroidered with laurel leaves, the emblem of the Ministry of Justice. To the young party also belonged the court uniforms, which here and there ornamented the crowd. But the division into young and old did not coincide with the separation into parties. Some of the young ones, as Lievin observed, belonged to the old party, and on the other hand, some very aged noblemen conversed in whispers with Sviatsky, and evidently were warm partisans of the new party. Lievin stood with his own group in the small hall, which was used as a refreshment and smoking room, listening to what was being said, and vainly straining his mental powers to understand it all. Koznishev was the centre around whom the rest were grouped. He was now listening to Sviatsky and Kliustov, the marshal of another district, who also belonged to their party. Kliustov was unwilling to go with the members for his district to invite Snetkov to stand again for election. Sviatsky was persuading him to do so, and Koznishev approved of this. Lievin did not see why his party should ask the marshal to stand when they wished to defeat him. Oblonsky, who had just had something to eat and drink, came toward them in his chamberlain's uniform, wiping his mouth with his scented and bordered lawn handkerchief.
"We are holding the position, Sergei Ivanich," said he, smoothing back his whiskers.
And after listening to the conversation, he backed Sviatsky's opinion.
"One district is sufficient, and Sviatsky evidently belongs to the opposition," he said.
And everyone but Lievin understood him.
"Well, Kostya, you too seem to have got a taste for it," he said, turning to Lievin and taking him by the arm.
Lievin would have been glad to get a taste for it, but could not understand what the point was. And stepping aside from the group, he told Oblonsky of his perplexity as to why the marshal of the province should be asked to stand again.
"Oh, sancta simplicitas," said Oblonsky,
and briefly and clearly explained the matter to Lievin. "If, as in former elections, all the districts nominated the provincial marshal, he would be elected receiving white balls from everyone. This we do not want. Now, eight districts are willing to invite him to stand again. If two districts refuse to do so, Snetkov may decline to stand, and then the old party might choose another of their members, and then all calculations would be upset. But if only Sviatsky's district does not invite him, Snetkov will stand. He will even get a good number of votes, so that the opposition will be misled. And when a candidate of ours stands, they will give him some votes." Lievin understood, but not fully, and wished to put some further questions, when suddenly everyone began talking at once and moving noisily toward the large hall.
"What is it? What? Who? An authorization? To whom? What? Rejected. No authorization. Flerov is not admitted. What if he is being prosecuted? In that way they can exclude anybody. It's mean. The law."
Lievin heard shouted from various sides, and he went toward the large hall with all the others, who were hastening on, apparently afraid of missing something or other. Hemmed in by a crowd of noblemen, he approached the provincial table, at which the provincial marshal, Sviatsky, and the other leaders were having a heated dispute. Chapter 28. Lievin was standing some way off. He could not hear distinctly because of the stertorous and hoarse breathing of one nobleman near him and the creaking of the stout shoes of another. He could hear only the distant, soft voice of the marshal, then the shrill voice of the venomous nobleman, and then Sviatsky's voice. They were disputing, as far as he could make out, about a paragraph of the law and the meaning of the words, "against whom legal proceedings were taken." The crowd separated to make way for Koznishev to approach the table. He waited for the venomous nobleman to conclude, and then said he considered the proper course would be to consult the wording of the act, and requested the secretary to look it up. The act provided that in case of a difference of opinion, the question should be balloted upon. Koznishev read the act aloud and began to explain its meaning, but a tall, thick-set, round-shouldered landowner with a dyed moustache, wearing a tight uniform, the high collar of which squeezed up his neck at the back, interrupted him. Advancing to the table, he struck his ring against it, shouting in a loud voice,
"Vote! Put it to the ballot! Enough talking! Vote!"
At this, several voices were heard, and the tall landowner with the ring, growing more and more spiteful, shouted louder and louder, but it was impossible to make out what he was saying. He was demanding the very thing Koznishev was proposing, but he evidently hated Koznishev and his party, and this hatred communicated itself to all those on his side, and in turn evoked a similar, though more decently expressed, feeling of conflicting anger from the opposing party. Shouts arose, and for a moment there was such confusion that the marshal had to call for order.
"Vote! Vote! Everyone who is a nobleman will understand! We shed our blood! The Emperor's confidence! Don't audit the marshal! He's not a shop assistant, but that's not the point! Kindly ballot, abominable!"
was heard shouted by spiteful, furious voices from every side. The looks and expressions on the faces were yet more spiteful and furious than the words. They expressed implacable hatred. Levin could not at all understand what was the matter, and was astounded at the ardour with which they discussed the question whether Flerov's case should be put to the ballot or not. He forgot, as Koznishev afterwards explained to him, the syllogism that for the common welfare it was necessary to displace the marshal of the province. But to defeat the marshal it was necessary to have a majority of votes. To obtain that majority, it was necessary to secure for Flerov the right to vote. And to secure Flerov's eligibility, it was necessary to explain the meaning of the law.
"A single vote may decide the whole matter, and one must be serious and consistent if one wishes to be of public service," Koznishev had said in conclusion. But Levin had forgotten that, and it pained him to see these good men whom he respected in such an unpleasant, malevolent state of excitement. To free himself from this feeling, he went, without waiting to hear the end of the discussion, into the refreshment room, where there was no one except the waiters at the buffet. When he saw the waiters busily wiping crockery and arranging plates and wine glasses, and saw their calm yet animated faces, he experienced an unexpected feeling of relief, as if he had come out of a close room into fresh air. He began pacing up and down the room, watching the waiters with pleasure. He was particularly pleased by one old man with grey whiskers, who, while evincing contempt for the young men who were making fun of him, was teaching them how to fold napkins. Levin was just preparing to start a conversation with the old waiter, when the secretary of the Court of Nobility, an old man whose speciality it was to know all the nobles of the province by name and patronymic, diverted his attention.
"Please, come, Konstantin Dmitrich," said he. "Your brother is looking for you. The vote is being taken."
Levin entered the hall, was given a white ball, and following his brother, Sergei Ivanich, approached the table at which Sviatsky stood with an ironical and impressive look on his face, gathering his beard into his fist and smelling at it. Koznishev inserted his hand in the ballot box and placed his ball somewhere, and making way for Levin, paused beside him. Levin came up, but having entirely forgotten how the matter stood and being confused, he turned to Koznishev with the inquiry,
"Where am I to put it?"
He spoke in a low voice at a time when people nearby were talking, so he hoped his question would not be heard. But the talk stopped, and his improper question was heard. Koznishev frowned. "That depends on each man's convictions," he said severely. Several persons smiled. Levin blushed, hastily thrust his hand under the cloth that covered the box, and, as the ball was in his right hand, dropped it on the right side. When he had done so, he recollected that he ought to have put in his left hand also and thrust it in, but it was too late, and feeling still more confused, he hurried away to the very back of the room.
126 for, 98 against, came the secretary's voice.
dropping his R's. Then followed a sound of laughter. A button and two nuts had been found in the ballot box. Flerov was qualified, and the new party had scored. But the old party did not consider itself defeated. Levin heard Snetkov being asked to stand, and he saw that a crowd of nobles surrounded the marshal who was speaking. Levin drew near. Replying to the nobles, Snetkov spoke of the confidence and affection of the nobility of which he was not worthy, his merit consisting only in his loyalty to the nobility to whom he had devoted 20 years of service. Several times he repeated the words, "Have served to the extent of my power, faithfully and truly. I appreciate and thank." Then suddenly, choked by tears, he stopped and left the room. Whether those tears resulted from a consciousness of injustice done him, or from love for the nobility, or from the strained situation in which he found himself, surrounded by enemies, at any rate his emotion communicated itself. The majority of the nobles were touched, and Levin felt a tenderness for Snetkov. In the doorway, the marshal came into collision with Levin.
"Sorry, please excuse me,"
he said, speaking as to a stranger. But recognizing Levin, he smiled timidly. It seemed to Levin that Snetkov wished to say something, but could not speak from agitation. The expression of his face and his whole figure, in uniform with crosses and white trousers trimmed with gold lace as he went hurriedly along, reminded Levin of a hunted animal conscious that things are going badly with him. This expression on the marshal's face touched Levin, particularly because, just the day before, he had been to his house about the wardship and had there seen him in all the dignity of a kind-hearted family man. The large house with the old family furniture, the old footman, by no means smart, rather shabby but respectful, evidently former serfs who had remained with their master, the stout, good-natured wife in a lace cap and Turkish shawl, caressing her pretty granddaughter, a daughter's daughter, the manly young son in the sixth form of the high school who had just come home and who kissed his father's large hand in greeting, the impressive, kindly words and gestures of the host, all this had yesterday awakened Levin's involuntary respect and sympathy. Now the old man seemed touching and pathetic to Levin, and he wished to say something pleasant to him.
"So, you are to be our marshal again," said he.
"Hardly,"
replied the marshal, looking round with a frightened expression.
"I am tired and old. There are others worthier and younger than I. Let them serve."
And the marshal disappeared through a side door. The most solemn moment had arrived. The elections were about to begin. The leaders of both parties were making estimates and calculating on their fingers the white and black balls they could reckon on. The debate about Flerov had given the new party not merely his vote, but also a gain in time, so that they had had a chance to bring up three more nobles, who, by the machinations of the old party, were to be prevented from taking part in the election. Two of these noblemen, who had a weakness for wine, had been made drunk by Snetkov's agents, and the uniform of the third had been carried off. The new party, having heard of this, had had time, while Flerov's case was being discussed, to send two of their men in a carriage to supply that nobleman with a uniform and to bring one of the tipsy ones to the assembly.
"I have brought one. I soused him," said the landowner who had been to fetch him, approaching Sviatsky. "He'll do."
"He's not very drunk. He won't fall down?"
asked Sviatsky, swaying his head.
"No, he's fine. If only they don't give him anything here. I told the man at the bar on no account to let him have anything."
Chapter 29. The narrow room in which they were eating and smoking was full of noblemen. The excitement was ever increasing, and anxiety was noticeable on all the faces. Especially excited were the leaders, who knew all the details and the estimates of votes. They were directors of the impending battle. The others, like the rank and file before a battle, though preparing for the fight, sought distraction meanwhile. Some of them ate, standing or hastily sitting down at the table. Others smoked cigarettes, pacing up and down the long room, and talked to friends they had not seen for a long time. Levin did not want to eat and did not smoke. He did not wish to join his own set, Koznishev, Oblonsky, Sviatsky, and the others, because among them, in animated conversation, stood Vronsky, wearing his uniform as an equerry. Levin had noticed him at the elections the day before and had carefully avoided meeting him. He went to the window and sat down, looking at the different groups and listening to what was being said around him. He felt sad, chiefly because he saw that everyone else was animated, preoccupied, and busy, while only he and a mumbling, toothless, quite old man in naval uniform who had sat down beside him were uninterested and inactive.
"He is such a rascal. I told him not to, really. In 3 years he could not collect it."
A short, round-shouldered landowner with pomaded hair that hung down on the embroidered collar of his uniform was saying energetically, stamping loudly with the heels of the new boots he had evidently put on specially for this occasion. And casting a discontented glance at Levin, he suddenly turned away.
"Yes, it's a dirty business, say what you will," remarked an undersized man with a feeble voice.
Following those two, a whole crowd of landowners surrounding a stout general hastily approached Levin. Obviously they were seeking a place where they could talk without being overheard.
"How dare he say I gave orders to steal his trousers? I expect he drank them. I snap my fingers at him and his princely title. He has no right to say it. It's mean."
"But excuse me, they rely on the statute," someone in another group was saying.
"The wife ought to be registered as belonging to the nobility." "What the devil do I care about the statute? I speak frankly. That's what the nobility are for. One must have confidence. Come, Your Excellency, a glass of fine champagne."
Another group followed close on the heels of a nobleman who was shouting loudly. He was one of those who had been made drunk.
"I always advised Maria Semyonovna to let her estate, because she will never make it pay,"
said a pleasant-voiced landowner with a grey moustache, wearing the uniform of colonel of the former general staff. It was the landowner Levin had met at Sviatsky's house. He knew him at once. The landowner also recognized Levin, and they shook hands.
"Very pleased to see you. Of course I remember you. Very well. Last year, at Sviatsky, the marshal's house."
"Well, how is your husbandry getting on?" Levin inquired.
"Oh, still the same. With a loss," replied the landowner, as he stopped beside Levin, with a resigned smile and a look of calm conviction that it must be so. "And how do you come to be in our province?" he asked. "Have you come to take part in our coup d'etat?"
he went on, pronouncing the French words firmly but badly.
"All Russia has assembled here. Chamberlains and almost ministers."
He pointed to the portly figure of Oblonsky in his chamberlain's uniform with white trousers, walking beside a general.
"I must confess to you that I only imperfectly understand the meaning of these nobility elections," said Levin.
The landowner looked at him.
"But what is there to understand? It has no meaning whatever. The nobility is an obsolete institution which continues to act through inertia. Look at the uniforms. They tell the tale. This is an assembly of justices of the peace, permanent officials, and so on, but not of nobles."
"Then why do you come?" asked Levin.
"From habit, for one thing. Then one must keep up one's connections. It's a sort of moral obligation. And then, to tell the truth, I have a private reason. My son-in-law wishes to stand for a permanent membership. They're not well off, and I want him to get it. But why do such gentlemen come?" he went on, indicating the venomous gentleman who had spoken at the provincial table.
"He is one of the new nobility. New, if you like, but not the nobility. They are landowners. We are country squires. They, as noblemen, are committing suicide."
"But you say it is an obsolete institution."
"It is obsolete, certainly.
but all the same one should treat it more respectfully. Take Snetkov. Whether we are good or bad, we have been growing for 1,000 years. You know, if we had to make a garden in front of our house, we should plan it out. And if a century-old tree is growing on that spot, though it may be rugged and old, yet you won't cut it down for the sake of a flower-bed, but will plan your bed so as to make use of the old tree. It can't be grown in a year, he remarked, cautiously, immediately changing the subject. Well, and how is your husbandry getting on?
Oh, not well. I get about 5%.
Yes, but you don't reckon your own work. You know, you too are worth something. Now, take me. Before I took to farming, I was getting 3,000 rubles a year in the service. Now I work harder than I did in the service, and like yourself, I clear about 5%, and that only with luck. And my own labour goes for nothing.
Then why do you go on with it, if it is a clear loss?
Well, you see, one goes on. What would you have? It's a habit, and one knows that it's necessary. I will tell you, moreover,
and leaning his elbow on the window, and having started talking, the landowner went on,
my son has no taste at all for husbandry. It is clear he will be a scholar, so that there will be no one to continue my work, and yet I go on. Just now, you know, I have planted an orchard.
Yes, yes, said Levin, that is quite so. I always feel that I am getting no real profit out of my estate, and yet I go on. One feels a sort of duty toward the land.
I'll tell you something, continued the landowner. My neighbour, a merchant, called on me, and we went over the farm and garden together. He said, everything is going as it should, only your garden is neglected, though my garden is quite in order. If I were you, I should cut down those limes, but it must be done when the sap rises. You must have 1,000 limes here, and each one of them would yield a good lot of bast, and at present bast fetches a good price, and the trunks could be cut up for log huts.
Yes, and with that money he would buy cattle or a piece of land for a mere song, and would lease it to the peasants, added Levin with a smile, having evidently more than once come across such calculations, and he will make a fortune, while you and I must be thankful if we can keep what we have and leave it to our children.
You are married, I hear, said the landowner.
Yes, replied Levin, with proud satisfaction.
Yes, it is curious, he continued. We live without gaining anything, as if we were appointed, like the Vestals of old, to guard some fire or other.
The landowner smiled under his grey moustache.
There are those among us, too. For example, our friend Sviatsky, or Count Vronsky, who has now settled here, who want to turn agriculture into an industry. But as yet, that leads only to loss of capital.
But why don't we do like the merchant? Why don't we cut down our limes for bast? Said Levin, returning to the thought that had struck him.
Why, as you have said, we guard the fire. The other is not work for the nobility. Our work is not done here at the elections, but at our homes. We have a class instinct as to what should not be done. I see it in the peasants, too, sometimes. A proper peasant always tries to get hold of as much land as possible. However bad the land, still he ploughs it. It brings him also no profit, but pure loss. Just like us, said Levin.
Very, very glad to have met you, he added, seeing Sviatsky approaching.
We two have met for the first time since we were at your house, said the landowner, and have indulged in a chat.
Yes, and have you been abusing the new order? Asked Sviatsky with a smile.
We won't deny it. Unburdening our souls.
Chapter 30 Sviatsky took Levin's arm and led him back to his own group. This time it was impossible to avoid Vronsky. He was standing with Oblonsky and Koznishev, and looked straight at Lievin as he came up.
"Very pleased. I think I had the pleasure of meeting you at the Princess Shcherbatsky's," said he, holding out his hand to Lievin.
"Yes, I well remember our meeting," said Lievin,
and blushing scarlet immediately turned and spoke to his brother. Smiling slightly, Vronsky continued his conversation with Sviatsky, evidently having no desire to start a conversation with Lievin. But Lievin, while talking to his brother, kept looking round at Vronsky, trying to think of something to say to him in order to mitigate his rudeness. "What is delaying matters now?" asked Lievin, glancing at Sviatsky and Vronsky.
"Snetkov. He must either decline or accept," replied Sviatsky.
"Well, and has he agreed or not?"
"That's just it. Neither the one nor the other," answered Vronsky.
"And if he should refuse, who will stand?" asked Lievin, looking at Vronsky.
"Whoever likes," replied Sviatsky.
"Will you?" asked Lievin.
"Certainly, not I," said Sviatsky, becoming embarrassed and casting an alarmed glance at the venomous gentleman who was standing beside Koznishev.
"Who then? Nevedovsky?"
said Lievin, feeling that he had put his foot in it somehow. But this was still worse. Nevedovsky and Sviatsky were the two prospective candidates.
"Not I. Not on any account," said the venomous gentleman.
So this was Nevedovsky. Sviatsky introduced him to Lievin.
"Well, has it touched you to the quick, too?" said Oblonsky, winking at Vronsky. "It's like the races. It makes one inclined to bet on the result."
"Yes, it does touch one to the quick," replied Vronsky. "And having once taken the matter up, one wants to carry it through. It's a struggle," he said, frowning, and closed his powerful jaw.
"What a capable man Sviatsky is. How clearly he puts everything."
"Oh, yes," replied Vronsky absent-mindedly.
There was a pause, during which Vronsky, since he had to look at something, looked at Lievin. At his feet, his uniform, and then his face. And noticing the somber eyes fixed upon him, he remarked, just to say something, "And how is it that you, living constantly in the country, are not a justice of the peace? You are not in the uniform of a justice."
"Because I consider that the magistracy is an idiotic institution," morosely replied Lievin,
who had all the time been looking for an opportunity of speaking to Vronsky to atone for his rudeness at their first encounter.
"I don't think so." "On the contrary," said Vronsky, with calm surprise.
"It's a game," Lievin interrupted. "We don't need any justices of the peace. I have not had a single case in 8 years, and when I did have one, it was decided wrongly. The justices' court is 40 versts from my house. To settle a matter worth 2 rubles, I should have to send an attorney who costs me 15.
And he related how a peasant stole some flour from a miller, and how, when the miller spoke to him about it, the peasant sued him for libel. All this was untimely and foolish, and Lievin himself was conscious of it even while he spoke.
"Oh, he is such a crank," said Oblonsky, with his smoothest and most almondy smile. "But come, I think the ballot has begun."
And they separated.
"I don't understand," said Koznishev, who had observed his brother's awkward sally. "I don't understand how one can be so entirely devoid of political tact.
That is what we Russians lack.
The marshal of the province is our opponent, and you are ami cochon with him and ask him to stand.
But Count Vronsky, I do not make a friend of him. He invited me to dinner, and I shan't go. But he is one of our party, so why make an enemy of him? Then you ask Nevedovsky whether he will stand? That kind of thing is not done." "Oh, I understand nothing about it. It is all trifling," said Lievin gloomily.
"There, you say it's all trifling, but when you begin on it, you make a mess of everything."
Lievin remained silent, and they entered the large hall together. The marshal of the province, though he felt in the air that there was a plot prepared against him, and though he had not been unanimously asked to stand, had still decided to do so. There was silence in the hall,
and the secretary loudly announced that Mikhail Stepanich Snetkov, captain of the guards, was nominated for the post of provincial marshal, and that the ballot would now be taken. The district marshals carried little plates filled with ballot balls from their own tables to the provincial table, and the election began.
"Put it on the right,"
whispered Oblonsky to Lievin as the latter, with his brother, followed the marshal to the table. But Lievin had forgotten the plan which had been explained to him, and was afraid that Oblonsky was making a mistake when he said right. Surely Snetkov was their opponent. While approaching the box, he had the ball in his right hand, but, thinking it was a mistake, he shifted it to his left hand just as he reached the box, and evidently placed it to the left. An expert standing beside the box, who, by the mere motion of an elbow, could tell where every ball was put, made a wry face. There was nothing for him to exercise his penetration upon this time. All became silent again, and one heard the balls being counted. Then a solitary voice proclaimed the number for and against. The marshal had received a considerable majority. A clamour arose, and everyone rushed to the door. Snetkov entered, and the noblemen thronged around him with congratulations.
"Well, is it over now?"
Lievin asked his brother.
"It's only beginning,"
Sviatsky smilingly answered for Koznishev. "The other candidate may get still more votes." Lievin had again forgotten about that. He only now remembered that there was some subtlety in it, but he was too bored to recollect what it was. He was overcome by depression and wanted to get out of that crowd. As no one was paying any attention to him, and he apparently was not wanted by anybody, he went quietly to the small refreshment room, and again felt great relief when he saw the waiters. The old waiter offered him something to eat, and Lievin accepted. Having eaten a cutlet and beans and talked with the old man about his former masters, Lievin, not wishing to return to the hall where he had felt so out of his element, went up into the gallery. The gallery was crowded with smartly dressed women who leant over the balustrade and tried not to miss a single word of what was being said below. Beside the women sat or stood elegant lawyers, spectacled high school teachers, and officers. Everyone was talking about the elections, and how tired out the marshal was, and how interesting the debates had been. In one group, Lievin heard them praising his brother. A lady was saying to a lawyer, "How glad I am to have heard Koznishev. It was worthwhile going a little hungry. Delightful. So clear and audible."
"There now, no one speaks like that in your court, except perhaps Madel, and even he is far less eloquent."
Having found a vacant place at the balustrade, Lievin leant over and began to look and listen. The noblemen were sitting behind partitions arranged according to their districts. In the centre of the room stood a man in uniform who announced in a loud, shrill voice,
"As candidate for the post of provincial marshal, Captain Evgeny Ivanovich Apuhtin will now be balloted for."
Then followed a dead silence, and a feeble voice was heard saying,
"Declines. Court Councillor Pyotr Pyotrovich Boll will now be balloted for,"
cried the voice of the man in uniform.
"Declines,"
shouted a youthful, squeaky voice. A similar announcement was made, and again followed by declines. So it went on for about an hour. Lievin, leaning over the balustrade, looked on and listened. At first he was surprised and wanted to understand what it meant. Then, coming to the conclusion that he could not understand it, he grew bored. Then, remembering the agitation and anger he had witnessed on all faces, he felt sad, and with the intention of leaving the place, went downstairs. As he was passing through the corridor behind the gallery, he came across a dispirited high school pupil with bloodshot eyes pacing up and down. On the stairs he met a couple, a lady running up swiftly in her high-heeled shoes, and the assistant public prosecutor.
"I said you would be in time," the assistant said, as Lievin stepped aside to let the lady pass.
Lievin was already descending the stairs to the exit and getting out his cloakroom ticket when the secretary caught him.
Please, come, Konstantin Dmitrich. They are voting.
The candidate who was standing was Nevadovsky, who had so decidedly declined. Levin went up to the door of the hall. It was locked. The secretary knocked, the door opened, and two landowners with flushed faces plunged out past Levin.
"I can't stand it!"
cried one of the red-faced landowners. Then the head of the provincial marshal was thrust out at the doorway. His face was dreadful from its expression of exhaustion and fear.
"I told you to let no one out!"
he shouted to the doorkeeper.
"I was letting people in, Your Excellency!"
"Oh, Lord!"
said the marshal of the province with a deep sigh, and with his weary legs in the white trousers dragging and hanging his head, he went down the middle of the hall to the chief table. Nevadovsky had a majority, as they had expected, and he was now marshal of the province. Many were cheerful, many contented and happy, many were in ecstasy, and many dissatisfied and miserable. The old marshal was in despair and could not hide it. When Nevadovsky left the hall, the crowd surrounded him and followed him enthusiastically, as it had followed the governor of the province on the first day when he opened the meeting, and as it had followed Snetkov when he was successful. Chapter 31. The newly elected marshal of the province and many of the victorious new party dined that evening at Vronsky's. Vronsky had come to the elections because he felt dull in the country in order to proclaim to Anna his right to freedom, to repay Sviatsky by supporting him at these elections for all the trouble he had taken for Vronsky at the Zemstvo elections, and most of all to perform strictly all the duties of the position he had taken up as a nobleman and landowner. But he had not at all expected that the election business would interest him so much, and so touch him to the quick, or that he could do it so well. He was quite a new man in this circle of noble landowners, but he evidently was a success, and he was not mistaken in thinking that he had already gained influence among them. This influence was promoted by his wealth, by his title, by the splendid house in the town which had been lent him by his old acquaintance Shirkov, a financier who had founded a flourishing bank in Kashin, by the excellent chef whom he had brought from his estate, by his friendship with the governor, who had been a former comrade, and one whom Vronsky had even protected, but above all by his simple behaviour in treating everyone alike, which had quickly induced most of the noblemen to change their opinion as to his supposed pride. He himself felt that, except that crazy fellow married to Kitty Shcherbatsky, who, apropos de bottes, had with rabid virulence told him a lot of pointless nonsense, every nobleman whose acquaintance he had made had become his partisan. He saw clearly, and others acknowledged, that he had contributed very much to Nevadovsky's success. Now, at his own table, celebrating Nevadovsky's election, Vronsky experienced a pleasant feeling of triumph. The elections themselves interested him so much that he began to think that if he were married by the next triennial election, he would himself put up, just as, when a jockey had won him a prize, he had wished to ride a race himself. They were now celebrating the jockey's victory. Vronsky sat at the head of the table. On his right was the young governor, a general of the emperor's suite. For everybody else, the general was the master of the province, who had solemnly opened the sessions and made a speech, and, as Vronsky saw, aroused both respect and servility in many present. But for Vronsky, he was Maslov Katka, the nickname he had had in the Cour des Pages, who felt embarrassed in his presence, and whom Vronsky tried to mettre à son aise. On Vronsky's left sat Nevadovsky, with his youthful, dogged, and venomous look. Toward him, Vronsky was simple and courteous. Sviatsky bore his failure cheerfully. It was not even a failure for him. As he himself said to Nevadovsky, champagne glass in hand, no better representative of the new course which the nobility ought to follow could have been found. And therefore all that was honest, as he remarked, was on the side of today's success and triumphed in it. Oblonsky, too, was pleased that he had spent his time merrily and that everyone was satisfied. At the excellent dinner, the episodes of the elections were discussed.
Sviatsky comically mimicked the old marshal's tearful speech, and, turning to Nevedovsky, remarked that His Excellency would have to adopt a different and more complex method of auditing the funds than tears. Another witty nobleman narrated how footmen with knee breeches and stockings had been imported to wait at the ball which the marshal of the province had intended to give, and that they would now have to be sent back, unless the new marshal would give a ball with stockinged footmen. During the dinner, they continually spoke of Nevedovsky as our provincial marshal, and addressed him as Your Excellency. This was uttered with the same pleasure with which a newly married woman is addressed as Madame and called by her husband's name. Nevedovsky pretended not merely to be indifferent to, but to despise this title. But it was evident that he felt happy, and exercised self-control to avoid betraying a delight ill-suited to the new liberal circle in which they found themselves. During the dinner, several telegrams were sent to persons interested in the elections. Oblonsky, who was feeling very jolly, sent one to Dolly, which ran as follows. Nevedovsky elected by majority of 20. Congratulations. Tell news. He dictated it aloud, saying, I must cheer them up. But Dolly, on receiving the telegram, only sighed over the ruble it had cost, and understood that it had been sent toward the end of a dinner. She knew that Stiva had a weakness at the end of a dinner party, faire jouer le télégraphe. Everything, including the splendid dinner and the wines, which did not come from Russian merchants but were imported ready-bottled from abroad, was very distinguished, simple, and gay. The company of 20 men had been selected by Sviatsky from adherents of the new movement and from liberals, men who were also witty and respectable. Healths were drunk, also half in jest, to the new provincial marshal, to the governor, to the bank director, and to our amiable host. Vronsky was satisfied. He had not at all expected to find such a pleasant tone in the provinces. When dinner was over, things became still merrier. The governor asked Vronsky to accompany him to a concert in aid of a brotherhood which was being arranged by his wife, who wished to make Vronsky's acquaintance. There will be a ball afterwards, and you will see our society beauty. Really, she is quite remarkable. Not in my line, answered Vronsky, who was fond of that English expression, but he smiled and promised to come. When they had already quitted the table and had all begun smoking, Vronsky's valet came up to him with a letter on a salver. From Vozvizenskoy, by express messenger, he said, with a significant glance. It is extraordinary how much he resembles the public prosecutor, Sventitsky, remarked one of the guests in French of the valet, while Vronsky, frowning, read his letter. The letter was from Anna. Even before he read it, he knew its contents. Expecting the elections to end in 5 days, he had promised to return on the Friday. It was now Saturday, and he knew that the letter contained reproaches for his not having returned punctually. The letter he had sent off the evening before had probably not yet reached her. The contents of the letter were just what he expected, but its form was unexpected and particularly unpleasant to him. Annie is very ill. The doctor says it may be inflammation. I lose my head when alone. The Princess Barbara is not a help, but a hindrance. I expected you the day before yesterday, and am now sending to find out where you are and what the matter is. I wished to come myself, but changed my mind, knowing that you would not like it. Give me some reply, that I may know what to do. Baby was ill, and she wished to come herself? Their child ill. And this hostile tone. The innocent mirth of the elections, and this dismal, burdensome love to which he must return, struck Vronsky by their contrast. But he had to go, and he took the first train that night for his home. Chapter 32 Before Vronsky went to the elections, Anna, having considered that the scenes which took place between them every time he went away could only tend to estrange them instead of binding them closer,
resolved to make every possible effort to bear the separation calmly. But the cold, stern look on his face when he came to tell her he was going offended her, and even before he had gone, her composure was upset. Later on, meditating in solitude on that look which expressed his right to freedom, she, as usual, came only to a consciousness of her own humiliation. He has the right to go when and where he pleases. Not only to go away, but to leave me. He has every right, and I have none at all. But knowing this, he ought not to do it. But really, what has he done? He has looked at me coldly and severely. Of course it is indefinable, intangible. But it was not so formally, and that look means much, she thought. That look shows that he is beginning to grow cold. Though she was convinced that this was the case, she could not do anything, could not in any way change her relation to him. Just as heretofore she could hold him only by means of her love and attractiveness, and just as heretofore, only by occupations by day and morphia by night, could she stifle the terrible thought of what would happen if he ceased to love her. True, there was one means, not of holding him, for that purpose she wished for nothing except his love, but of putting herself in such a position that he could not abandon her. That means was divorce and marriage. She began to wish for this, and decided to agree the first time he or Steva should mention it to her. With these thoughts in her mind, she spent 5 days, the days she expected him to be away. Walks, talks with the Princess Barbara, visits to the hospital, and above all, reading. Reading one book after another filled her time. But on the 6th day, when the coachman returned from the station without him, she felt that she was no longer able to stifle the thought of him and of what he was doing. Just then, her little girl fell ill. Anna nursed her, but this did not divert her thoughts, especially as the illness was not dangerous. Try as she might, she could not love that child, and she could not make a pretense of love. Toward the evening of that day, being alone, Anna felt such terror on Vronsky's account that she decided to go to town. But after careful consideration, she wrote that contradictory letter which Vronsky received, and without reading it over, she sent it by express messenger. Next morning she received his letter, and regretted her own. She anticipated with horror a repetition of that stern look he had thrown at her when leaving, especially when he should learn that the little girl was not dangerously ill. But still, she was glad she had written. Anna now acknowledged to herself that he was weary of her, and would regret giving up his freedom to return to her. Yet in spite of this, she was glad that he would come. Let him feel weary, but let him be here with her so that she might see him and know his every movement. She was sitting in the drawing-room, reading by lamplight a new book by 10, listening to the wind outside and expecting every moment the arrival of the carriage. Several times she had thought she heard the sound of wheels, but had been mistaken. At last she heard not only the wheels, but also the coachman's voice and a dull rumbling in the portico. Even the Princess Barbara, who was playing patience, confirmed this, and Anna, flushing, rose. But instead of going downstairs, as she had already done twice, she stood still. She suddenly felt ashamed of having deceived him, and still more afraid of how he might treat her. The feeling